Welcome to Syntax. Today we've got a show for you on web scraping and reverse engineering APIs. So it's been a while since we've done a show like this, and it's a personal hobby of mine. I've written so many scrapers in my day, and I've learned quite a few things about how do you scrape data off of web pages? How do you interact with web pages in a way where maybe they didn't necessarily mean for you to use the website in that way? So today we're going to go into all the tips and tricks and tools on writing a web scraper for your own benefit. My name is Wes. I'm a developer from Canada. With me as always is Scott. How are you doing today, Scott?
Oh, I'm doing okay, man. Hey, we had a wild weekend. We had our school auction because our kids go to public schools here. So they, you know, have fundraisers and stuff. And My wife, Courtney, decided to be the co-chair of the auction, which we've heard is kind of like a hell job. Everybody is often talked about how that's not something that you want to do. But she decided to step up and try to co-chair it up. And my gosh, dude, they crushed it. They raised the most money they've ever raised here. Everything was went off without a hitch. The event was great. All the parents were happy. It was just a wild weekend. But man, we've been a little stressed over here at the household kind of leading up to this event. So it was really cathartic to get that out. And, you know, it was such a release that on Sunday, she was just totally wiped. And so it was just What an eventful weekend. But man, it was really cool. I got to do some dancing at the event too.
Did you auction yourself off? Was it one of those dinner no. with Mr. Talinsky?
I wish. No, it was no. no, it was just there's all the parents donated a bottle of wine, so then you could try to win
that too.
50 bottles of wine or whatever, or different events. People were putting up their vacation homes. The cool thing about Colorado is a lot of parents have vacation homes in the mountains.
We did that for our school's auction as well. We give our cottage up for a week. Mm-hmm. And it fetches a pretty penny because
it does.
A week at a cottage is not cheap. And then often you'll have the grandparents or whatever paying up a little bit just so that the school can get a little bit more money.
Plus tax write-offs, right? Free money.
Yeah, can I do that?
I don't know. We can't if it's a charitable donation. It depends on, there's a value minus the thing. It's a charitable donation technically.
I didn't even think about that.
Especially since it's donated. Yeah. I know there was my dad used to do a guitar auction, and he would get a bunch of guitars from famous musicians. And the rule with that was you could write off anything that was the value of the guitar, whatever you spent minus the value of the guitar, you could write off. So, they were cheap guitars, but they would be signed by, famous people. That's what made them valuable. So it was nice to be able to write that kind of stuff off as charitable contributions. Let's say here's stuff you also want to write off, Wes. You want to sometimes write off bugs that are coming into your Sentry because somebody's scraping your website and causing maybe potentially unforeseen issues. Man, we see some wild stuff in our Sentry sometimes, whether it's bots hitting us from trying to find our WP admin or whatever. But it's nice to have that visibility into the terms of what's going on in your application. And even if things aren't being used like they're supposed to being used, you don't want your app to crash because WestBoss is trying to scrape it and found something going on here or triggered some sort of...
The amount of code paths that we've hit where we didn't expect something to happen and we find it in Sentry, certainly because of bots, has been wild. You don't think that someone's going to send a payload that is not JSON to a specific endpoint that doesn't exist in via a put request, they try everything. And it's kind of interesting because you find all these use cases that you didn't expect, and then first of all you scratch your head, be like, what is somebody doing? But Sentry gives you such good insights into, for us, you can clearly see that they tried /WPAdmin they try all these common routes, a known exploit of a WordPress plugin, and then you can clearly tell that it's a bot trying a bunch of these things. We still should fix this thing where it broke, but we don't have to stress that this is an actual user hitting those endpoints.
Absolutely. Well, if you want to have that kind of visibility into your application, head on over to Sentry.io/syntax, sign up and get 2 months for free. It's an awesome tool and I got mine open all the time. So let's get into scraping. First and foremost, what is it? Why might you want it? Well, sometimes you want to get some data from websites, whether that is behind the login portal or in front of the login portal. Maybe there's a host of websites, several websites, and you want all that data. Not every website has an API. In fact, most websites don't have an API. Not only that, if they have an API, maybe that API costs money to use. And we saw this with Twitter. They pulled the rug on everybody who was using the API, and all of a sudden the API became prohibitively expensive. Same thing with Reddit, right? Now all of a sudden, you can't use their API, even though the API exists, to grab the data. So even if they have an API, it's not assured that you'll be able to grab data from various websites. So you might be thinking, all right, if the app doesn't have a data, am I out of luck? No. That's where scraping comes in, because guess what? We have computers, and computers can read websites too. And on websites is more than just divs and all that stuff. It's text, it's information. And you can navigate through actual websites with code, grab data, store it, do something with it, analyze it, use it for various purposes. I think about like all kinds of data aggregate systems. There's things like Social Blade that are hitting all the different social accounts and logging their follower numbers and putting them in big tables so that you can follow. They're not doing that through APIs. That would be just too impossible, especially with things like Instagram, which doesn't even have a public API like that. There's podcast aggregators. We get all kinds of emails from people being trying to get on the show because they found us on some podcast aggregation website that says, here's the podcast you got to get on. And those are grabbed through scraping. They're scraping information from the various podcast hosts or the various players, grabbing public information of the charting data and able to put it into a big table. So basically, scraping is here to give you access to all of the data on the World Wide Web for the most part. And if so, even if it doesn't have an interface to do that.
Yes. And we should say, all of the stuff today is in a legal gray area. A lot of people would say, like, if these websites don't want you to access this information in that specific way, then you shouldn't be doing that. And to a certain point, I agree, especially with all the AI stuff that's been popping up in the last little while. Is the reason why Twitter and Reddit and all of them are clamping down their API and really getting aggressive against scrapers. Like, Twitter is one of the hardest things to scrape. I've done it, but it's really tricky. The reason why they're doing that is because these people that are building AI models are hungry for data, and they just need more data. They need all the data in the world to train their models on. And that's, your data is one of the most valuable things that a different service can have. But let's talk about like some examples of things that I've done in the past. So my brother-in-law wanted a PlayStation 5 when they were really hard to get. So I wrote a quick little scraper that every 5 minutes would ping several websites and let me know when one is available. We did a whole show on how I built a COVID vaccine notifier. And I basically just pinged. I just thought it was really interesting. I pinged like 100 different pharmacies from 6 different stores every half an hour, and it worked. Actually, it worked in like a day, and I called them up and they're like, we just posted that like 3 minutes ago, how do you know? And I was like, I wrote a scraper. Marketplace, I used to flip road bikes, and I've written a couple marketplace scrapers over the years that would scrape Craigslist, or Kijiji is one we had in Canada. It doesn't work as well anymore now that everybody is just chronically on Facebook, and the inefficiency of things being for sale on Craigslist type websites has sort of gone away because you can't search for mislabeled things, like misspelled things, and you can't just look at all the images really quickly, because Facebook's marketplace has gotten so good that it knows what you're looking for, and it knows what's in the image that someone has posted, and it's sort of gotten rid of that inefficiency there. But I've written, back in the day, this is probably 10 years ago, I wrote a scraper that would text me every single time one of the keywords that I was watching. So I would be searching for like Fiori and Bianchi and all these like a nice Italian road bikes. And as soon as one popped up, It texted me. I clicked on it. I called the guy, and like I would be able to just like nab these like beautiful old road bikes that are worth like $800, $1,000. I would get them for like $100 sometimes.
Wow.
That was just because I was able to jump on it. Cloud app downloader. So I've been using this app called Cloud App. It's called Zeit now, which is very confusing because Zeit is now Vercel. and they're basically like this little screenshot file hosting tool. I've talked about it many times, how the quality's sort of gone downhill. And I was sort of thinking like, I kind of want to move to something else, but I'm not lying. I have 13 years, 12,000 files Wild. On there. Holy so I was like, cow. How do I get this? And I emailed them like, we can give you a zip file. And I was like, I'm just going to write a scraper. So I fired up this thing called Proxyman. I reverse engineered their API and I wrote a little script that downloaded the list of every single one of my drops, all of the data about the drop. I threw it in a database and then I downloaded every single file. And I have this like 300 gig folder now of every single thing. And I'm kind of like, I just want to delete all this because almost all of it I don't need, but there's probably 10 or 15 files on there somewhere. I can also sort by how many times people have viewed the file, so I might do that as well.
I can relate to that so much because I just looked. I have a Hazel script. Hazel's an app that like puts things like it will look for files and moves them into places automatically for you. So I have a Hazel script for me that looks for any file with the word screenshot in the title. So anytime I take a screenshot and puts it into a directory, I just checked my screenshot directory, Wes. It has 1,000 items. It is 100 megabytes. And why don't I just delete this thing? I should just be dumping this thing periodically. Why do I need 1,000 screenshots? I'm never going to go back and look at these, apparently.
Oh, man. So you can change where the screenshots go in in macOS. How come you have to have a Hazel script for that?
Because it's a part of my overall Hazel flow. So what I don't want is I don't want the configuration for all these things to be in the various apps. When I take a screenshot, it just goes to the default place, right?
Desktop.
Likewise, anything that ever lands on my desktop gets run into my Hazel script and it gets
into you want it to trigger on anything.
Correct. It gets put into the inbox, and the inbox is on my Synology. That inbox then has a whole host of its own scripts where it then, you know, takes things where they need to go.
Yeah.
Central station routing. Cool. Yeah. So I only have to go in one place to ever figure out my automated file routing.
Yeah. And you can put anything in there. Like I have one of those for, what's the hike files, H-E-I-C. Whenever I send a photo from my phone to my desktop, it's like a hike and you can't upload those anywhere.
Oh my
God. I just immediately have it converted to JPEG so I could throw it in a file. And I think it also strips my EXIF data as well because those photos have like GPS.
Yeah, your location data.
Email to the wrong person, you know? What else have we built here? Spotify stats scraper. So I was curious, like, what our stats look like over time, like where we are on the rankings of podcasts, as well as where other like coding podcasts are. So we wrote a little scraper that sort of tracks that over time. I've written social stats. I have a playlist on YouTube about how to scrape Twitter, Instagram, TikTok followers just to get stats over time. Canadian Tire, this one's really funny. So in Canada, we have this thing called Canadian Tire, which is this really weird store that sells tires, obviously, but it sells, I don't even know. It's the most overstimulating store. They sell a million things. They have houseware stuff. They have paint. It's kind of like a hardware store meets a department store. It's very, very bizarre. Meets like a dollar store. Bizarre area, and they have like clearance at every store, and sometimes you can find stuff for like a dollar, and if you know where to look, then you can do it. But I just wrote a little script that you give it your location, and it just goes off, downloads a page of every clearance item, sorts it, and then compares it by the regular price and the clearance price, and if it's over like 90% off or like whatever threshold I've sent it to, it'll just log it for me and I can go and see it. Cause I've gotten some good deals on like rechargeable batteries. At one point I got some, and some pretty interesting stuff there.
I got some good deals on rechargeable batteries at Canadian Tire. I built a web scraper to do that. Oh man, I'm really stoked to be able to talk to you about this because you are kind of like you're a scraper OG. You've been scraping, you know, since I was just first writing some JavaScript myself. So you've been at the scraping game a long time. And the only scraper I've really written is one to grab exercise information from my exercise machine. They have a host of exercises that are built into this thing, but they don't make it public. So I, you know, grabbed the APIs and have been scraping images, have been scraping all the exercise names and all the information so that I can put together like a custom little exercise builder online for it. It's just slow going and I have a lot of side projects, but that's really the only like actual scraper I've spent any time on.
They're super fun. And I honestly think you learn a lot about how web tech works. You learn a lot about how websites try to stop mischievous actors from running. You learn a lot about how authentication works and how long authentication is good for. I feel like I've learned so much by writing scrapers, and I don't know why it's something that I enjoy so much, but like I said, I've written it millions of times. With Darcy, I wrote a daily deal scraper. That was like my first like business. I've talked about that many times on, and that was with PHP, and I use this thing called PHP query, which like re-implemented jQuery. That was like probably 15, 20 years ago. Wow. Scraping is wild. A lot of people use it to track competition, to check for stock on specific items, to view stats over time. The stats one is really interesting because a lot of times when you have a stats dashboard, it doesn't give you all of the data that you actually want, right? Like the one thing I love about YouTube is that it gives you that 1 out of 10 score, and it tells you how it's doing in comparison to your other videos 3 hours in, 4 hours in. And that's really handy. I kind of wish that we had that with our podcast as well. It's like, how is this podcast doing within the first 24 hours versus the rest of the podcast within the first 24 hours? Apple gives us that data really well, but Spotify doesn't. So let's talk about how to actually do it. You got to decide, first of all, you have to decide how can you access the type of data. And that will determine what type of scraper you're going to build. It is always the easiest to write a scraper in server-side JavaScript. So it's always easiest to write it in Dino, Bun, or Node, rather than having to puppeteer it, run something in the browser, and try to fake clicks. So the categories I've broken it down into here are client-side. First of all, if it is something that has to happen in the browser, A, because you can't figure out how to do it programmatically, or B, you just don't care that much and you just need to get the data really quickly. Sometimes your scrapers can simply just be some code that you copy-paste into the console, a GreaseMonkey script or a Chrome extension that gives you the data out the other end. Sometimes you just need to simply just say, it's on this page, I need it, but I need it in a different format than what it is. And you can sometimes just write a little script, paste it in the console, and it gives you the data out the other end. You also need to ask yourself, does this need to be rendered in the browser before I can get the data? So for example, if you scrape Twitter on the server, you're going to get a page with, sometimes you're just going to get a page that says, please enable JavaScript. When you fetch a URL on the server, you are not running that in a JavaScript environment. It's simply just a request to a server, and the request comes back and gives you whatever exists on that thing. Likely it's going to be some HTML or a JSON API, something like that. But often the page needs to first load some JavaScript, then it goes off to another API, fetches some like tweets, and then comes back and will render that out to the page. And that is really tricky. We'll talk about how to do those multi-step in just a second, but ask yourself, is this something that can only be done client-side? In most cases, the answer to that is no. You can figure out how to do it on the server. Is it a private API? So this is a very common way to do scraping. I would say this is probably the most common way to do scraping Canadian Tire, they don't offer a public API. However, if you go to CanadianTire.com, open up DevTools, start clicking around, you're going to immediately go to the network tab and then filter for the XHR tab. As soon as you start clicking around, you're going to see requests going back and forth to API endpoints. And if you look at those, you can sort of start to reverse engineer what their API endpoints are. And that's the ideal scenario. If you can replicate the request that the website itself is making to their own private APIs, then things are very easy from that point forward. There's often auth involved or session tokens. We'll talk about how to get those in just a second as well.
Yeah, it's funny. We did an episode on this a little while ago, not on scraping specifically, but about the hidden web, which was like private APIs and things like that, where we talked about some of this stuff. And go back and listen to that episode if you're interested more in ProxyMan, because we talk about connecting even to your iPhone to scrape on native apps, not just web apps, right? So you can access a lot of stuff with things like ProxyMan beyond just clicking around a website if you have a native app. Let's say that's what I was working in. My Tonal thing, only a native app. So there's definitely a lot of cool stuff you can do with that app.
Yeah. So with the cloud app that I was talking about earlier, first thing I did is I went to the website and I clicked on page one of my screenshots, and it loaded all my screenshots. I'm like, okay, good. And then I opened up DevTools, went to XHR, clicked on next page, and just did a full page reload. Mm-hmm. And I was like, damn it. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously here I could scrape the thumbnails and the links from that, but it actually doesn't have all the information that I want. So what I ended up doing is there's this application called ProxyMan, and ProxyMan will, like Scott says, you can fire it up on your computer and it'll allow you to proxy HTTPS traffic, and it will show you every single request that every single app on and every single website is visiting. And it's wild if you open it up to see how often these applications are calling home, mm-hmm. and with what information. You're like, you know, what are they sending mm-hmm. about me? Sometimes you just hover over a navigation item in an app and it immediately sends data back to the home base. Be like, user hovered navigation item at 4:27 p.m.
Adobe is checking the date of the time.
Oh my gosh, yes.
That's a throwback to anybody who ever has installed Adobe Photoshop.
So I did this and I found the API for Cloud App or Zite. And then I just looked in, I'll talk about the authentication cookies in just a second, but I was able to reverse engineer the whole API and just use it to download everything. And I'm pretty sure I was the first person to do it, because I often, when I find endpoints, I'll go and search that endpoint on GitHub. And almost always you can find somebody else that's already dipped into this already and you can learn a few tricks from it, but there was nothing behind it. The next one is it server rendered? So this is becoming more, it was for a long time, and now it's becoming more popular again, is instead of having private APIs that you can ping for your data, often these services will now just have straight up rendered HTML. And if that's the case, you have to download the HTML and then somehow reconstruct the DOM and pick out the pieces that it is that you're looking for. And often that will require, if you need all of the information, it will require you like grabbing page one, and then for every single item on the page, you have to make another request to that specific pages to download all the information about it. So it can be quite a few requests to get this data, and it can be kind of slow if they don't offer a private API. And then the last little trick I have here is initial state is really nice to grab from. So specifically, Instagram does this. Often when React applications or any single page application are server rendered, what will happen is they will render out the HTML that needs to be rendered, and then it'll be rehydrated on the client. And part of that rehydration is they'll dump an object of their initial state, and in that object is generally all the information that you want. So a list of your most 20 most recent Instagram posts, you can often just pick up that whole blob of data, JSON parse it, and then boom, you got all the data that you're looking for. I had written that for my personal website. I think it is. Let's see. Is it broken right now? It breaks all the time. No, it's working right now. That's how my Instagram widget on westboss.com works, because I, of course, Instagram doesn't offer any way to do that. So I even wrote one for Instagram stories, but that one seems to be broken at the moment.
Yeah, it is funny because you are since these aren't like versioned APIs, you're beholden to the way the application works. And if they change it ever so slightly and the thing you're querying off of or looking for doesn't exist anymore, it's moved, the document structure has changed, you might just have yourself a broken thing. So you might always find yourself chasing a train here.
Yeah. One more thing I should say is if it is client-side only, you'll need to reach for what is called a headless browser, meaning that instead of just grabbing the HTML or the JSON that's on the page, you need to actually visit the website and run JavaScript code on that page. And if that's the case, you'll have to reach for Puppeteer, Playwright, Cypress. These are all headless browsers that you can sort of puppeteer behind the scenes and tell it to, all right, wait 2 seconds, click on this page. And those are really hard. Those are much harder for websites to detect because it mimics an actual user, especially if you change the user agent. It will mimic a user as close to a user as possible.
Yeah, and the reason why that is, in case anybody isn't familiar, is because straight up, when you have client-side rendered JavaScript, again, that is rendered on the client. And if you're hitting it from the server, you're going to get HTML with the JavaScript file. So what these things are doing is they are loading up the application as if it was a real website in a real browser. It's just not showing you or rendering it visually. And this is the same way that you said Cypress or these types of things. This is the way Cypress or Playwright do testing is by opening up your site in a real browser and then almost knocked my coffee over, and then inspecting the DOM. I'm gesticulating too much. Inspecting the DOM and making sure things interact the way that they should, as if a real user was using it, which is one of the reasons why end-to-end testing on the web is such a great way to test.
Exactly. It's as the user would be able to access it. It's not a great way to scrape because it is very slow to be able to do this. It is much faster just to ping it. And that's why, like, if you are waiting for a page to load and then it loads data and then you can scrape it, try to cut out the middleman and figure out how do I make the request for the data directly. And you can usually figure that out via the network tab in your dev tools or something like Proxyman application if it's a native app. Working with the DOM. So my favorite package for this type of thing is Linked DOM, LinkedDOM. If you Google it, it will try to autocorrect it to LinkedIn. And this is a fantastic package that will, you give it a string of HTML that you get from a fetch request. And maybe I should say that is like, how do you make requests to website from Node.js? Fetch. Fetch is how you do it, right? You simply just fetch westboss.com and then the response that comes back, instead of saying response.json, you say response.text, and that will simply just give you the entire HTML package that has been returned. And then you take that HTML and you pass it into something that will recreate the DOM, but on the server side. And for the longest time, Cheerio was really popular there. It gave you a whole jQuery-like thing. Then we had JS DOM. Linked DOM is the best. It's just so simple. It just works. It's just all browser APIs re-implemented on the server. And it also works in service workers and Cloudflare workers. So whether you're using Cloudflare, Bun, Dino, you're using anything, it just works. And it's such a fantastic package.
Is there a reason it's better than JS DOM? Is it just because it's more modern? Is that it? It just implements everything and works with everything? Is there any like special sauce there, or is it that's it?
I don't know why. All I know is that I've always just had pain with JS DOM.
I think a lot of people have gotten NPM errors or who knows what with JS DOM.
Yeah, I think the reason why I initially switched to it is because JS DOM didn't work in Cloudflare Workers and it didn't work in Service Workers. And then I just moved to this Linked DOM and it works everywhere.
Nice.
So I've just been, and so once you get that, you get back, you get a window, you get a document, you get the HTML, and you can then use query selector all. You can then select items. You can loop through them. You can get the inner HTML. You can create new items. You can parse them out. Anything that you're used to in vanilla JavaScript in the browser works in Linked DOM. And then it's up to you to simply just parse out the HTML, all of the elements. Usually what I'll do is I'll try to find what's a selector for each individual item. And then I'll select all those items on the page, and then I'll just loop over them and write a little function that converts it from a bunch of selectors to a JavaScript object that has the raw data that I'm looking for.
Yeah, that's nice. And
yeah,
and typically, you know, again, you kind of have to get a lay of the land of what their HTML is looking like when you're working with this DOM stuff, because, you know, some people got some really crazy HTML, and I think that is, you know, one thing that is good at being able to parse this kind of stuff or really dive into it. So you get to see all the kinds of wild things that are existing in actual production websites, whether that's infinitely nested divs or spans or whatever. You might find yourself really having to get deep into some nested structures here.
Yeah, if you take a look at Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter's source code, there's not a single class on any of the elements that will tell you what is in that. And that is intentional, because Twitter has a massive bot problem, and making it a little bit harder so that someone can't find the button that has a class of tweet, or somebody, they can't find all the divs that have a class of reply. It makes it a lot harder.
Advertisements to block ad blockers.
Oh yeah, and advertisements and all that. And that's not the only reason why those classes are like that. They're because of React Native Web, because they use the same code base on their React Native application. If you go back to episode 650, syntax.fm/650, we have a whole episode of that's called "Why is Facebook's HTML and CSS such a mess?" Which is like a tongue in cheek, because it's like it looks like a mess, but it's not. It's very intentionally done.
It's because they're not good at coding, right? That's why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So if you don't have classes to select things, how do you find the elements? So here are some tricks that I use. First of all, look for ARIA labels. The benefit of making a website accessible is that at one point you have to put ARIA labels on your divs, and those are a very clear giveaway as to what the thing is. So if you go, let me go on twitter.com right now. I'll put a screenshot in the YouTube video of this specific one. So if you look at DevTools on Twitter, everything is just like CSS dash some random ID. However, there is an ARIA dash label timeline, your home timeline, right? Like, and that, how do you grab that? Well, you use a JavaScript selector, a CSS selector, which is square bracket ARIA dash label equals or star equals. You can do a fuzzy match, and then you can do star equals timeline or home timeline or something like that, and that will grab the element with your home timeline, and then from there on out you can generally find, okay, the list of all the tweets is going to be six levels deep, and often they are also going to have their own ARIA labels on top of them. If they don't have ARIA labels on them, Twitter also does leave their test IDs on their elements. So often people will put data dash test ID so that they can use something like Cypress or any of these framework testings. They can just grab onto an element with their testing framework and make sure that thing has a link inside of it, make sure that it has an image that has loaded, make sure that it has the number of likes, you know, like they test for all those things.
And those can be removed sometimes at build time, but oftentimes I think a lot of people don't have that process in their build pipeline.
Yeah, I tweeted about it, and one of the devs at Twitter was like, "I told you." He's like, "I internally advocated for stripping those out because of bots," and I was like, "Please don't remove it. I need this for my because I have a Chrome extension called TweakDeck, and it changes TweetDeck." And he's like, "We have too much stuff to do. We're not going to remove test IDs."
That's very fun. Yeah, that would be a pain, right? To rewrite all your tests to hunt for something that's not a test ID, especially with dynamically generated classes.
Yeah, and even then, if the idea with these test IDs is you're testing it as the end user would see it. And if you're stripping them, then what the end user sees and what you see in your test environment is technically different, right? Even though you're just stripping them out. So I thought that was kind of funny. If you can't use ARIA selectors or data test IDs, there's this thing called XPath, which is part of the XML spec. Mm-hmm. And XPath is like probably 20, 25 years old. And there's one cool thing in XPath is that it allows you to select elements based on its text. So if you, at the very end of the day, need to be able to select a button that says post, or you need to be able to select a div that has like items on clearance, you can use XPath to select an H2 tag where the text is equal to clearance. And then you can grab the parent, and then you can go down a level and find all the items inside of it.
Hmm.
Make them as flexible as you can. Don't assume any classes. If you can, obviously. Often I'll assume like levels deep, so I'll go down two levels deep. But again, this stuff breaks all the time.
Changes.
Because
yeah.
Anytime someone changes their markup, then everything is broken. AI is really good at this as well. So all of this like obscure parsing, sometimes you could just give AI the HTML and say, hey, parse this out. And
that's
give me
really
an,
good at that. Yeah.
An array. Yeah, it's really good at that. So like all of these tips I've had are almost moot because you can just give the output to ChatGPT or you can give it to Claude or any AI API and it will return to you. It's not, of course, it's not 100% perfect, but I would say it's probably more, what's it,
more better. I would say it's more better. Yeah, than
it's probably yes. more better than everything else. And it's not great at math. Like you can't say like, oh, give me the items that are the most marked down, but simply just parsing it into an array of objects with your raw mm-hmm. data, then you can go map, filter, reduce. I'll go crazy on it.
Yeah, totally. And I do find that to be a specific use case in which AI can really, really come in handy in terms of, like, if you give it a lot of data, it's always good at going through that data and suggesting you maps or loops or whatever to parse that data. I've had nothing but positive experiences there, especially if you know what you're doing, because then it outputs the code. You read the code. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's good. Works.
Downloading files is something I had to do as well. I wrote my last one in Bun just for shoots and giggles, but Bun has this amazing... I'm always torn between these APIs. Bun mm-hmm. has an amazing file writing API and reading API where
it does. It, yeah.
to a point where you can say bun.write file and you pass it a fetch request or not a fetch request, a response. So the awaited version of a fetch, and it will simply just write it to file for you. There's no chunking. There's no putting the chunks together, waiting for that to be done, which is, I'm Mr. Let's get standards for this type of thing, but
you're
man,
Mr. Chunk.
That is a good API.
Yeah, I agree. And that, I actually had that same situation with several Bun situations where there's the file router API
yes.
or stuff like that. I'm like writing Bun software. I'm like, should I be doing this or should I just be trying to write it so it works with any runtime? You know, it's such a tough place to be.
The downside there is that Winter CG, the community group that's trying to standardize these APIs, they've said, we're not going to do file APIs because not everyone has a file API. Like Cloudflare doesn't have a file API. There's no file system in Cloudflare. But like, I kind of feel like, I feel mm-hmm. like we need it. Like I took a screenshot of Scott being like, yeah, I wrote it in Bun because they've their file API. There's no standard file API. There's a browser file API, which maybe we should adapt to the server.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there is no server API that is standardized. So Node.fs is kind of the API, but it's not as good as Bun. So
yeah,
hard place to be.
I've used the browser one. It's good, by the way. It's nice.
Is it? Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, let's get that in everywhere. Let's talk about working with protected routes. So often you will go and just fire off a fetch request and you'll get back like a login screen or a 404 page or a 500 page, and it's not what you see in the browser. So how do you remedy that? Almost always when you send a request in the browser, there's going to be some information that comes along with the request, especially if you're logged in. There's going to be a cookie, there's going to be a session token, there's going to be a JSON web token that comes along with the request, and it will tell the browser, all right, give me a list of items that are first on clearance, but here's my like little token that comes along with it. So often you need to send that token along as well via the headers part of your fetch request. So the way that you can figure out what do I need is you go into DevTools, you make a request, you find the request, you right-click on the XHR request, and you say copy as fetch, or I think in Chrome it's called copy as Node.js fetch. And what they'll do is they will also give you every single header that was sent along with that request. Then what you do is you stick that in like a JavaScript file. You try run it. Almost always it will work and you'll see, okay, I see the actual data I'm looking for. And then you got to kind of reverse engineer it and just start deleting things from that headers, because 90% of it you don't need. But there's usually one of them, one cookie in there that you do need, or one.
Maybe one or two, yeah.
Authorization bearer header that comes along. So just delete them, rerun it after every delete. Or do like the bisect thing where you delete half and see if it still works. Then you're going to figure out which cookies are absolutely necessary, or which I shouldn't say cookies, because they're not always cookies. Sometimes it's not always headers. Cookies.
Just headers, yeah.
And then you say, all right, I got that. You throw those in a .env file, because you should treat those as passwords, right? They shouldn't go directly in your code. And then you can send them along. Often those cookies are good for, or those headers are good for, long, long time, like 6 months, a year, something like that. If that's not the case, you have to figure out, like, here's another example I have is I have a trading account with some bank, right? And I want to be able to log the progress.
Which bank? The number?
Allow me to tell you.
Would like that. Yeah.
but I want to be able to log exactly what was traded every single day and the levels. And I want to be able to go back in time and see what those are. Mm-hmm. And that data is not available via the API, right? It does show you the amount that you have over time and how they've done, but it does not show you what has been bought and sold over time. And I was like, I want every single day, I want that data, right? So I wrote something that will download it. But the login cookie is only good for like an hour or something like that. And then the cookie expires. So I have to do a two-step process where first you take your username, password, ping it, come back. And there's no, Canadian banks are amazing. There's no two-factor authentication here, which is really frustrating. So I just have to ping it with username, password. I use the 1Password integration to get the environmental variables out of my 1Password into environmental variables. So there's no, you're not just putting your password in a text file on your computer. And then that what comes back from that is a JSON web token. So it's not a cookie in this case, it's a JWT. And then I make my subsequent request to their API with that JSON web token. And that gives me the data that I need and I can save it to disk. Sometimes you'll need to post those things to log in. So again, you have to go use your fetch request. You have to change the method, change the headers. It's not too tricky. There's also a plugin called Fetch Cookie on Node. It's a Node package. And what this will do is instead of you having to keep track of a cookie, because if you log in, the request that comes back has a header called Set Cookie. Mm-hmm. And it tells the browser, set this cookie. So that the next time you send a request, the cookie comes along for the ride. If you're just using fetch requests, there's no concept of a cookie jar, right? There's no concept of anything like that. However, the fetch cookie plugin or NPM package will allow you to do that type of thing. So you don't have to parse out the return values. I've never used that. I've never found it to be an issue where I've needed a cookie jar that automatically gets it. So You can grab it, although it's extremely popular package, so I know a lot of people do. Last thing I have here is just deal breakers, CAPTCHAs. So I've never run into a situation where a CAPTCHA has stopped me, and I think that's because I don't do nefarious stuff. Like I'm not trying to programmatically post data. I'm not trying to abuse APIs. I'm simply just trying to get some data that is rightfully mine or use it like a marketplace in a way that I'm not able to use it, right? So often when there are things like signing up for things or doing specific searches, or even like I was just searching for fiber internet packages. They're starting to lay fiber in my internet or in my area. I'm so excited. And in order to check if my address has fiber, you have to put a CAPTCHA in. Why? Mm-hmm. Because the competitors could just write a scraper that checks every single address in the entire city and get a map of, okay, this is where Bell
they're laying
has,
out. Yeah.
Yeah, they have fiber laid out here. Mm-hmm. You can get a lot of like market information via that. So there's obviously a CAPTCHA there. Though you can get around CAPTCHAs. There's packages that will send the request to a Mechanical Turk, and like somebody in a, some other country is sitting there and typing in the codes. It's a whole underground of trying to beat out CAPTCHAs, which I've never dipped into because I've never needed to, but you can't just bypass those, thankfully, because otherwise, like, I use CAPTCHAs on a lot of my stuff to stop people from submitting bad credit cards and whatnot into my checkout forms.
Yeah. Hey, did you see that story about the Amazon walkout yes. stores? Oh my gosh, that it was just a Mechanical Turk situation.
Yeah, explain that a little.
Yeah, from my understanding, there were the Amazon like physical stores that you could just walk in, grab your stuff, and walk out.
Grocery store.
It would use your phone to essentially charge you for everything that you took. But in reality, there were like people in, I believe, India that were processing the transactions manually themselves.
Like, so they're just watching you pick up things and put them back.
Yeah, they were like, when it was initially announced, it was kind of lauded, I don't know if that's the right word. It was initially said as like, hey, this is some cool, crazy new tech. And it's just a Mechanical Turk, which historically, that's like there was a machine that was a computer. And what was inside of it was just people. So that's where that term comes from. It's a very wild concept.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah, at a certain point, it makes more sense to pay somebody for 12 seconds of their time to do those types of things. I can't wait until that becomes an actual reality, though. Like, have you ever bought something at Uniqlo?
Yes.
Their checkout, so Uniqlo checkout, is literally a hole where you pour all the clothes that you want in.
Oh, you mean in person? No, I have yes. not. I always go online. Yes.
So we'll get Randy to throw up a photo of this. Basically, their checkout is an iPad and a little hole, and you throw the clothes that you want in the hole, and it has RFID chips on all the items, and it puts them all on the thing, and you pay for it. I was like, give me that for groceries. It drives me crazy that groceries is go to the store, take the item off the shelf, put it in your cart. Take it out of the cart, put it on the belt. Put it off the belt, put it in the
back of the cart. Or even scan
it
yourself, yeah.
Yes, and then take it out of the cart, into the back of the car. Take it out of the car, bring it into the house. Take it out of the house. I was like, just give me a fridge that I can bring to the grocery store and put the item in the fridge, and that's it. I'll bring the fridge back into the house, and we're done, you know?
That's hilarious.
Yeah, that $1 million idea. Someone please invent that. I'm sick of the extra steps of taking things in and out.
That's hilarious.
That's it. Sick. That's scraping. Very fun. Check it out yourself. Let's get into shameless plugs.
Yeah, sick picks. Sick picks. I'm going to sick pick a small little app for Mac OS, something that I use all the time. And you might have another tool for this. I don't know if Better Touch Tool does this, Wes, or I don't know, any of these apps that you probably have, but Keyboard Clean Tool. I use Keyboard Clean Tool once a week to clean my screen. I bought a bottle of this Zeiss lens cleaner, which is like alcohol free, so it's not going to ruin your screen, because if you use alcohol on the screen, it will remove the shine off of it. So Keyboard Clean Tool, it just makes it so it locks your keyboard, locks everything without you clicking and holding on a button for a specific time. And that makes it just really nice and easy to spray some on a thing and wipe down your keyboard, wipe down your screen, do it once a week, and your computer is not going to be awful. And it's a free little app, so might as well use it, right? So I'll post a link to that in the show notes.
This is by the same developer as Better Touch Tool. So
it is, okay, yeah.
That's awesome. That's so funny. Keyboard. I saw that the other day when I was on their website, because I was adding a couple more keyboard shortcuts for resizing my windows. And I was like, that's hilarious that he it looks like he spun out a couple parts of Better Touch Tool into smaller apps, because Better Touch Tool does everything under the sun forever. It's just the most wild, large app ever. That's, I don't know, $25 for a one-time buy. Hey, maybe that'll be my sick pick, is Better Touch Tool. So if you want to be able to instrument keyboard shortcuts, if you want to be able to have snapping areas for your windows, if you want to be able to resize your windows. So one thing I was doing is I saw on TikTok, this one guy was using this keyboard thing called Yabai. And I know there's a couple other ones like Rectangle and Amethyst. These are all window managers for resizing your windows.
Raycast
is good for that as well. And the one thing I saw on Yabai that I really liked is he had two windows or three windows side by side. And as he expanded one of them, the other ones would get smaller. Ooh. And I was like, oh, damn, I need that because I find myself, especially when I'm recording, I record part of my screen and I want to be able to make my code editor like, 70% wide and then my terminal 30% wide. And I know that Mac OS has full screen and you can drag and resize. That's not good enough. That's for kids. So Yabai has this thing where it'll tile them automatically for you. And I tried it and it's too much for me. It's like Vim, you know, you got to like spend your whole day doing it. And I have such a good, better touch tool system up and running already. So I wrote some keyboard shortcuts that would allow me to increment my window by 10%.
I do that too.
I still have to flip to the other one and decrement each one.
I do a hyper and then the arrow keys and it'll move it over more and more to the side, or up and it moves it more and more in the center.
maybe that's a hasty treat we should do, is simply just keyboard resizing workflows. Because,
well, let me tell you, Yabai is open source and it looks really cool. So
it's pretty cool. And the thing I didn't like about it is that it will always resize all of your open windows and you can set up a bunch of them. And
Yabai does this or what?
Was it? I think it was that or... Oh, no, I tried Amethyst.
Okay,
Amethyst.
I have not tried either of these.
It's the same idea. It's tiling, meaning that like it will always... Mm-hmm. If you close one, it will rejig it and you can set up shortcuts for them. But it's one of those things where it's like, I don't got the time to learn this thing. And I'm so happy, especially I have special recording window sizes that I need that are not my entire screen. Mm-hmm. So I need to be able to do that in Better Touch Tool. So I spent some time making custom keyboard shortcuts and very happy with it.
Word. Cool. Shameless plugs. Check out Syntax on YouTube. We're on YouTube. We release all kinds of stuff. And CJ Coding Garden has been doing a lot of content that's based on shows that we've done, where he'll do an hour sometimes on deep dives on topics that we do. So if you want to get deeper into some topics, he's been doing a whole series on self-hosting right now, diving deep into managing your own VPS. He's going to be talking about Coolify very soon. So a lot of cool stuff going on over there.
All right, that's it. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll catch you later.
Peace.
Peace.